Gang, are you looking for better sleep and relaxation or relief from pain or anxiety without feeling totally drugged? Well, let me tell you about True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. True Hemp Science promises premium quality, pure ingredients, and true value. They source the highest grade organic hemp from around the world to handcraft the finest full spectrum CBD products in the Austin area and beyond. They offer a complete line of full-spectrum CBD products, including oils, tinctures, skincare lotions, sports rubs, gummies, and chocolates. Gang, I've been using their products for a while now, and they've lowered my anxiety and given me incredibly restful sleep. How Did I Get Here has teamed up with True Hemp Science to bring you a very special offer that benefits all of us. Spend $100 or more at True Hemp Science, and they will include either the number 81 distillate, which is great for nighttime, or the number 23 distillate, which is great for daytime, with your order. And that is a $25 value. Just go to truehempscience.com/HDIGH. That's truehempscience.com/HDIGH. And balance your body and mind with True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. Let's get down. Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, whatever it is you did this week. The show's dropping on Friday, November 11th, which is Veterans Day here in the United States, and I want to send out a heartfelt thank you to everyone that has served our country. Wouldn't be here without you. You're appreciated. Gang, I had a great week. Yeah, I just tapped on the thing. I was in the studio for a couple of days over at the Bubble here in Austin, with the fabulous producer Frenchie Smith, working with Poet Hawkins, who is an artist in our artist development program over at the Austin Music Foundation. Sorry. Great time in there. We recorded two songs. You'll hear them in the new year. What fabulous artist, Poet Hawkins. Get out there and check him out. Such a great songwriter, such a great singer, man. It was magical being in there. Plus, it was super fun because he doesn't have a band, so we got to play a bunch of stuff too. So it was all around a great time and just a beautiful, they were super long days, but they were just really fun. I can't tell you. I was really inspired getting to be with an artist like that. Check him out. Poet Hawkins, I think he only has one song on Spotify and it's called Wild Ride. Great, great song. Then Thursday, I sat down and had a conversation with those music fans here in Austin. You know, Quiet Company, great band. Well, they're playing their last show on December 3rd. And Taylor Muse, who's a really good friend of mine, came over last night and we sat down and talked about Quiet Company, had the conversation. So you'll hear that in a couple weeks, the week of the show. I'll be dropping it like the Tuesday before the 3rd. So that's when you'll hear that one. Plus, gang, dude, Doug Wimbish from Living Color came over yesterday and we had an incredible conversation. My friend Alex Vallejo and Bevis Griffin are doing something with him over at the School of Rock, the music school here in town, and he was in town. They said, hey, you want to talk to him for the podcast? And I was like, hell yeah, I do. So this guy came over, and I mean, in the research for him, I knew he was Doug Wimbish. I knew he played on a bunch of records. I didn't know what records, right? So I was freaking out, man. He was like in the house band at Sugar Hill Records. He was the bass player in the house band at Sugar Hill Records. So he played on songs like White Lines by Grandmaster Flash. He played on Mick Jagger's solo album, Primitive Cool. He played on Michael Bolton Records, James Brown, Ron Wood, Madonna, Annie Lennox. He was on Seal's first album, the one with Crazy. That's him playing bass on Crazy. Jesus Christ. Carly Simon, Al Green, Puff Daddy, Michael Hutchence, Herb Alpert, Depeche Mode. Just insane. Plus, he's in Living Color. He's been in Living Color since like 1992. Anyway, we have a fantastic conversation. You'll hear that in a couple weeks. So yeah, it's been a busy week. I'm going to Houston to play a show tomorrow, Saturday, taking Rosie with me, going to see the family. It's supposed to be freezing now. And gang, I want to let you know that Skyrocket will be at Mercer Dance Hall in Dripping Springs, Texas, next Friday, November 18th. Skyrocket will be playing there. It's going to be a busy week. Next week, I'll tell you all about it on Tuesday's show. All right. Hey, gang, I have an incredible show for you guys today. Singer-songwriter, Nashville-based singer-songwriter, Chris Canterbury is my guest on the show today. He's just released an incredible record, 9 songs that will just rip your heart out. It's so beautiful. It's called Quaalude Lullabies. And it's reminiscent of he took the approach of like Bruce Springsteen did with like Nebraska, like a stripped down record where you can just tell these stories. And the record's gorgeous. He produced it himself. This is the first time he went in there and really took the reins on the record. It's absolutely fantastic. You can find him at chriscanterburymusic.com. As I said, the record's called Quaalude Lullabies. Gorgeous record. Very, very honest lyrics about addiction, depression, and loneliness. And we have a really great conversation about making the record, about who he is as an artist, about growing up in Louisiana, moving to Nashville, getting out there and writing songs. He's kind of like a guy that's in the Mary Gaucher kind of vein of songwriting. You know, like a guy that really is out there trying to tell these stories about these characters through his own lens. Amazing, amazing songs. Chris Canterbury and I have a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. You can find him, as I said, at chriscanterburymusic.com. His record's called Quaalude Lullabies. Get out there and check it out. It's absolutely, absolutely gorgeous. That's what I say about it, all right? Enjoy my conversation with this amazing songwriter, Chris Canterbury. Let's get down.
1, 2, 3, 4. Try as I might to see the dark in the back of my eyes. There's an army inside my head. And a monster.
Quaalude Lullabies. What a, just, man, that is a heavy piece of work and a stark piece of work. And I see that you took the reins production wise on this.
Yeah.
What was the decision to take that step?
I had an idea for this record, for like this kind of little project, and it didn't really start out as an album idea. I was just going to record some songs that I'd written. And, after I got them all together and started thinking about it, realized it had been 5 years since I put a record out.
Yeah.
Or 4 years since I put a record out when I recorded it. And I was like, man, I think I just need to like go ahead and put this together. And I kind of wanted to make a concept record that wasn't a concept record, wherein it's I really like the vibe that Springsteen's Nebraska
right,
had.
Right.
Where it's like a bunch of elevated demos. Yeah. And it's like, well, maybe I can do that for, you know, for a shoestring budget. And once I got going with it, I was like, man, I think this is the way to do it.
Is that because that kind of the starkness of that record opened the road and cleared the space for these very intense descriptive stories?
I think it's more the record, like the songs all had this storyteller vibe. It's like there was like a,
yeah,
like chapters in a novel.
Yeah.
Or a collection of short stories, basically, I guess is what it would be. Yeah. More like.
Can I tell you something real quick that stands? I'm 54 years old, okay? And so I was like, I was in the MTV thing, like when MTV was coming out and really happening. And
yeah,
I believe that was, well, maybe he made a video for Rosalita, but it might have been later. But there was one video, and it was for Atlantic City. And all of these videos would come on MTV, like Duran Duran and Howard Jones and these guys saying all this stuff. And then there was this video that was this like black and white 16 millimeter, like kind of blurry footage. And the first line of the song is, Well, they killed the chicken man in Philly last night. And it was the only thing like that. It's making the hair on my arm stand up. It stood out so intensely in that world of things. And that's what I was thinking about, even in the world of music that you're in. If you're in like a country music world, your record, this starkness, really makes it stand out. It's not like you're doing over the top production. It's like you're stripping back the shit and filling in like the story.
Yeah. No, that's 100%. That's my MO as a songwriter is to play the songs. Is like to write the songs that I like that I write the songs that I want to hear and I want to hear about, and I like those. The Nebraska record was a big influence, like sonically.
Sure.
And it's that I still Open All Night, still one of my favorite songs of all time, regardless of the record. This is the, but yeah, that's like it was that feel is what I was trying to portray, but I didn't want to rip off the record. And sure. I just after I got all the songs laid out and kind of was going through them, like these are all little cinematic short stories,
right?
And each one of them, if it's told from a first person, it's still a story that I heard from somewhere else, or something that happened to somebody that I knew or somebody told me about. And I felt like I felt like those stories deserved an audience.
That's good. Okay. That's good, because I have written down like in my notes, "Are you okay, bro?" It's good to know that at least some of them are about other people.
It's not you would be surprised how often I get that.
I bet you do, man. Like when I was listening to it, I was like, oh man. How's he doing? Are you
everybody? I think everybody deserves a story, and sometimes they can't tell it themselves. So
that's right.
That's where I come in.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are all kinds of things. Like, I'm sure that even in those things, I'm a songwriter myself. If there's, even if you're telling somebody else's story, you are in there somewhere in the way that you react to things and your feelings about things and your point of view is in there somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Well, and telling a story sometimes too, from a first person standpoint, lets you put a little different. Let you emphasize things that you wouldn't emphasize, and you know, in other ways. So it's a cool. It's something that I've worked on, that I've like kind of honed in on over the last 10 years of writing these kind of songs.
Yeah, were you what? Obviously, the pandemic probably played into one of the reasons why this record took so long to come out. After your record before was Refinery Town, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what else took between Refinery Town and starting to work on Quaalude Lullabies? You put out Refinery Town. Did you go on tour?
I recorded Refinery Town. I recorded it in January or February of 2017, and I had a good budget for it, and then it's like all things in most businesses, it cost way more than what I expected it to, and I just didn't have a marketing budget for it, so I just kind of let it sit, like I recorded it and then put it out on my own and just let it sit, and it was like, okay, well, what do I need to do? And just I tried to like chase my tail to. It's like our chase mall, you know, like just trying to catch up with it and trying to like do something with it to make it work. And it's done. It's like that album did great, but it was, I didn't have a team behind it. Like I had I was able to have behind this one. And that was the biggest reason was I just, recording that record. And the difference in recording that record and the difference in recording this record and like are not necessarily recording, but releasing these records was vastly different. Like I was able to secure PR on this one, like I've distribution label and stuff like that. So we just kind of sat and waited for it, like, or waited with it and kind of held on to it until we could put it out at the right time.
It's interesting because there's somebody like you is so intensely creative and so so focused on your artwork and stuff like that, that what was that taking you away from it? Because it's interesting that your answer to what happened with the release of Refinery Town is to almost double down on the artistic level of what you're putting out. You know what I mean? Which is hard to do when you're grappling with the difficulty and the realities of dealing with some bullshit of releasing a record, which is a pain in the ass, like the day-to-day aspects of it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I doubled down. I feel like it's they were two separate beasts. That they like releasing a record on a with a releasing a record by yourself without a like with like just with nothing more than uploading it to a DSP to like a distribution site and then say okay it's out there tell all your friends on Facebook. And then actually having a team behind it, we're two vastly different processes. Now with this one, I was able to sit on this one a little longer and kind of wait for the perfect team to come around because I do basically because of the pandemic, for longer than I've been playing music, I do graphic design work. I owned a screen printing shop for ages, and I do logos, like branding, and then like album art and posters and things like that. And during the pandemic, the business when touring shut down, the business side of that kind of skyrocketed, and I was able to not have to like put this record out right after I recorded.
Right. I was going to say, that's really funny. Cause when I saw your logo for just your name, I was like, dude, this guy, for just a guy with just a name, like not even a band name, has the coolest logo of almost anyone I've seen with just a name.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man.
I'm proud of that one.
Yeah, you should be. It's really cool. Okay. So, all right. So, what I want to talk a little bit more about this record and kind of the recording of it. Who engineered it? Because there's some fucking drum sounds on there that are unbelievable. Like some of those super compressed, like kind of squashed back ones that are pretty badass.
I got you. Caleb Fisher at Farmland Studio here in Nashville. He was the in studio engineer. He engineered the whole thing, set up the studio, mic'd everything. And then Ross Touchette was the final mix.
Okay.
He mixed the record mixed it for post, and it was really I was blown away with how good the instrumentation sounds came out in this.
Yeah.
Everywhere from drums to the drums, the little flutter on the upright bass on Devil and Dealer is like one of my favorite parts And then the acoustic guitar mixes on Over the Line are just beyond beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you, okay, well, let's go back to, you're from Louisiana?
Yeah.
What part of Louisiana?
I grew up in North. I grew up in a little small town, probably 50 or 60 miles from, northeast of Shreveport. My hometown's, Haynesville, Louisiana. You drive 2 miles north of the north city limit sign, sign, and you're in Arkansas.
Okay.
So it's up north.
Yeah. Where did you go? What did you go to, like, the Bossier City Mall to, like, shop for your school stuff or anything? Yeah.
Pierre Bossier. Yeah, like we that was the closest.
That was the closest one. Yeah.
That was the closest thing that was there. Then there was a Pecanland Mall in Monroe, Louisiana. That was another place. I grew up in Hainesville, and then moved. And I ended up, when I started playing music, I moved to Ruston, where Louisiana Tech is, and then hung around there and played around.
Was that one of those places that, like, as an artist and as a creative person and as a person that has a dream, you got to get out of there? Like, is there an aspect of your life, like a component of your life of escaping the place you're in?
I don't know. I think everybody has, for the most part. I mean, everybody has that kind of like it's those kind of small towns. It's like, it's better to get out of.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, it's one of the, like, it's, I still go back. My parents still live there. I still go back. There's a redeeming quality about how slow it is, you know, in the technological sense. I don't have good service when I go there, like cell phone service. It's, like, it cuts out for 20-30 minutes at a time when you're driving through to get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's still I think it still only has two red light, two traffic lights and
yeah.
And a gas station that closes at 9 o'clock. So,
okay. So, what did your parents do? Like, what was their business? What was their work?
My mom worked at a bank, and my dad was my dad worked shift work at a local paper coating mill where they coat pretty much everything that you use. It's got a paper that has a plastic coating on it for.
Okay.
It ran through there, and I just when I was growing up, I worked at, my first job was at McDonald's for about 6 weeks, and then I worked at a grocery store, and then I worked at a liquor store, and then I kind of, from the liquor store, opened a screen printing shop, and
was there a need for a screen printing shop there?
I mean, there's a lot of churches and schools.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So they all need. I enjoyed doing graphic work at that time. And I was like, well, yeah, I had a little band, and we were, I'd print my stuff and all my friends' band merch.
That's cool. But what I'm trying to get at is, like, when did you find music, or when did music find you, or how did that whole thing go down?
I didn't start playing guitar until I was in college. And it's like, I was dating this girl, and she had a guitar in the corner, and I'm like, it'd be kind of cool if I learned how to play that thing. And, I started, my dad's brother, taught me, he played a little guitar, played some guitar. He was a music teacher and a band director in a high school. And he taught me a little bit of music theory and taught me some guitar. And I just kind of took it from there and, discovered that I really was into like Nirvana and Oasis and a bunch of those other bands that people in my age were into in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
And then
and how old were you?
Learned to play. When I learned to play guitar, I was 19. I was okay. 19. Almost 20, okay. I guess.
Sorry. So you started learning Nirvana and kind of like what the rock scene was at the time.
Well, I mean, I was into that kind of music. I was into the, and I have kind of just figured, like, that's what I would pick around when I was learning how to play. That's what I was like. I was playing those like three chord.
Sure.
Like there's three chord songs and everything. And then realize that it's like, I can make up words for this stuff myself. And sounds kind of cool. And then I I discovered I think I discovered Townes Van Zandt first, or Steve Earle first, and then it's like, okay, well, this is kind of cool. Like, I like this. This reminds me of me. And and then from there, through listening to Steve Earle, I listened to discovered Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt, and then that whole crew of like Texas underground, like singer, you know, degenerate singer songwriters.
Yeah, yeah,
I like their stories.
Yeah. Yeah, they're great. I live in Austin, and I've had a lot of those like Gary P. Nunn kind of guys on here and stuff like that.
Yeah, man, Gary P.'s awesome.
Yeah, like superheroes of that architecture of like outlaw country music. And you know what?
Yeah, that's like the.
It's funny because what you're doing is kind of outside the box of what the mainstream of country music would be, right? Do you even consider what you do country music, or do you consider it like Americana, or like what do you say? You're a folk singer?
When people ask, I just say I'm a singer songwriter. Because it's country to some people. It's not country to some people. It's not folk to some people, and I feel like you start putting genres or specific labels on it. And
to me, in like the family tree of music, you're on the same branch as Townes and Steve Earle, you know.
I think that's like if
you're
I look
same
at
family.
What, you know the kind of yeah,
yeah.
The people that inspired me, like the song and the songs that inspired me, then I would say that it's that group of country music. But it's a you can paint country with a wide, you know, with a wide brush. It's kind of, people like to argue about what country music is and what it isn't, but they don't really do the same with rock music. I mean,
I know what you mean. Well, there's a thing that happened to country music was that pop culture was always influencing it, but always had like there's a certain feel and sound to it. But then all of a sudden, like after the 90s, it was like people had listened to hip hop and, you know, Pour Some Sugar on Me was their favorite fucking, you know, song, even though they listened to country music, that was still their favorite song. You know what I mean?
Right.
I had that thing when I very first heard that from Shania Twain, I was like, that is like the most Def Leppard, like guitar tone and all this stuff. And a friend of mine, I think it was my manager at the time, was like, yeah, it's Mutt Lange. And I was like, oh, it's the same dude. And he's like, yeah, I was like, oh, thank God. Cause I was like, this chick is totally ripping off Def Leppard.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I mean, I think, like, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think I've read where Chad Kroeger from Nickelback has produced some like successful country records. And it's like, it doesn't surprise me.
No, it doesn't surprise
me. I'm sure they sound great. Like, music evolves, you know, there's styles and genres and people music evolves with people.
Correct. Correct. And I mean, you know, who knows what level of Nirvana stuck with you, you know, through when you really go through these Quaalude lullabies, maybe some of that mining the dark places of these things does come from sort of like that world, even, you know, you never even know.
Oh, it absolutely does. Like, I'll catch myself writing lines with like in co-writes and stuff. I'm like, and I have to like make sure I didn't lift it from a song I'd heard from Pearl Jam or Nirvana or something, you know, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Or I hear something and you can find the resemblance in it.
Right.
But I think that's part of the beauty of writing this kind of music is it kind of takes the grunge, some of those grunge era ideas and adds a banjo.
Right.
Or a,
right. Right. Right.
Or a little, or a deep Southern drawl.
Right. Well, that's, you know, man, there's a certain thing too about like, what you're doing musically, there's in that sparseness, especially on this record, in all of that sparseness, there's like an elegance to sort of your ability to convey your song in a way that you can grow old doing. Like, you look at a guy, I saw that you played with Ray Wiley, who's a friend of mine, and he's been on the show as well. Like, that's a guy that, like, I look at, and I've had this conversation with him a couple of times about, like, you know, as I get older in music, I look around and look at the generations ahead of me, and I'm like, you know, what path do I want to follow? You know, do I want to be like a Vegas kind of like show singer guy, or do I want to still be able to dig in deep and be real as an artist? And, you know, Ray's, you know, living proof that you can be, excuse the term, but old as fuck and still be cool as shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of, I think that's the beauty of this, this little subgenre of country music or America, you know, this little subgenre of roots music, is that it's something that you can, if you, like, I feel like I'll never not know how to tell a story a little bit differently than somebody else.
Right.
I feel like I'll like always have like this, this ability to describe a person in a setting with a set of accuracy that I feel like I'll be able to do. You know, that's something that I've honed down, that I know that I'm good at.
Sure.
And I enjoy it. I enjoy coming up with those, with that, you know, I enjoy writing those kind of songs, and as long as there's a market for it, I'll keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your song Fall Apart, like, is such a great description of the sort of loneliness of the day to day, you know what I mean? Working musician life. Yeah. And that kind of like,
it is. And I feel like, I also feel like this record is more, with the exception of a few songs on it, this record is more of a, I wrote it and released it for other musicians, in a sense. It's like, there's a lot of road worn musician songs on this album.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even some that are, I mean, like, even Over the Line as a truck driving song is kind of,
sure,
directly correlates with to being on the road as an aging musician.
Right. Kind of like that. Do you ever get into that Jackson Brown record, Running on Empty?
Yeah.
Like that whole record is just that. It's just, and it's recorded on the road. So magical.
Yeah. It's, I think like when I cut Refinery Town was a song, was an album about me. Like, it was, but not me necessarily as a musician, but me as like, it's like my, you know, story about my grand, you know, about my grandpa, or story here and there. The only song on there is, that's not about me. I'm going back. Oh yeah. The only one on there that's not about me is the song called Broken Man, which is about, even though I tell it from the first person, it's about a liquor store robbery I was reading an article in Newsweek one time, and about a mill worker in Lawrence, Kansas, who got laid off, and then 2 months later, walked into a liquor store with a shotgun, robbed it, got in the car, drove around the corner, and walked into a Walgreens and bought diapers and baby formula, and I wrote this song, but I wrote it in first person. And
from the perspective of the robber, sorry to interrupt you.
I wrote it from the perspective of the child.
Oh, okay.
Whose dad did this. But he's in the car the whole time. The mom and the son are in the car as he's going, you know, right, as he goes in to do this. But it's, I did make, I, I, like I recorded it in first person, you know, from a first person perspective, like it happened to me. And I didn't, when I put the record out, I didn't tell my dad that, after he listened to it. It's like, I was like, hindsight's 2020, you know, hindsight, I should have mentioned it, but I tell people, it's like, when I introduce the song, when I play, it's like, this is a song about my daddy robbing a liquor store. And then after the song, I was like, my dad actually did not rob a liquor store. but when he listened to it the first time, when the record came out, he listened to it and he's like, hey, he's like, I already, he's like, this sounds good, son. He's like, I'm proud of it. He's like, people don't really think I robbed a liquor store, do they? But I like that record was, it was a personal record. It was for, you know, a kind of about me, like a story of just stories around my life and around, you know, things that and this one was more of a, this one was more of a kind of a nod to like, my friends that are singer songwriters that travel, you know, that stay on the road nonstop. This record was kind of more of a song for other for the other songwriters in my peripheral.
Yeah. Who, like, I mean, you live in Nashville. Are you? Do you have a publishing deal? Or
I don't. I'm self pubbed at the time. Over the last 10 years, I've taken some meetings and here and there, and it's not, either they haven't worked out, or either they haven't worked out on their end, or it wasn't quite the deal for me on my end. And I write.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm not one of those writers who writes. I don't write every day. I mean, I guess I do in a sense, because I'm like, I always like make a little note or something if something comes up. But something hits me and I feel the need to write, like I'll hop down and write two songs, or I'll book a co-write with some folks, and we'll get together and toss around some ideas. And it might take us four times. It might take us four meetings to write that song. Right. Or we might knock out two in that day.
What is it called? Like 10 and 2 or whatever? There's like a word for those guys that do it. Like they go in at 10 and then they go to another one at 2 or something. I don't know.
Everybody here seems to write on the 11-3 schedule. Where it's like you write at 11.
Yeah.
If you write another one at 3.
Yeah.
All right. You just repeat it 5 days a week.
I've talked to a few people that live there and are not part of that system and don't really have much interest in being part of it. Like, the one that stands out the most, Mary Gaucher is, I don't know if you're a fan of hers, but it seems like you're of that same ilk of songwriter as she.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But she doesn't have any interest in, I mean, people cover her songs, but she doesn't want to go and do these appointment things and try and, she does them, but it's not like what her strength is.
There's a core group of people that I write with. I used to write solos, and then I would, you know, somebody would toss me an idea and I'd give them some feedback and we would, you know, I'd get a co-write that way or whatever. And then I have a couple of, like my buddy Monty Russell in Ruston, Louisiana. Like I write with him whenever I get a chance to. We always have, you know, we're on the kind of the same, we have a similar idea about where a song needs to go. And then I got a good friend in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, that's a really good songwriter, that when we get together we'll try to knock one out. But it's a Monty Russell in Ruston, Louisiana. I co-wrote Kitchen Table Poet with him.
Oh, cool.
That's on this record. And then Wade Reeves from Baton Rouge, and I wrote Felt the Same with him.
I know a couple of guys, a guy and a girl in Baton Rouge, Jody James and her boyfriend. I can't remember his name for some reason right now, but he's a nice guy.
Yeah,
Clay Parker. Clay Parker and Jody James, I think.
Yeah, Clay and Jody.
Yeah.
I've played with them a couple of times at Red Dragon Listening Room in Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. Like really, really, like super talented, super, super talented.
Yeah, they're great. I saw them during the pandemic. I'm forgetting the name of the lady. There's a lady, Bonnie Bishop. You know that lady? She's a songwriter.
Yeah. I mean, I know the name.
She lives out in Blanco, and she had some thing in her backyard. And like during the pandemic, like in the fall of 2020, I went out there with a girl I used to go out with is from Baton Rouge, and her best friend is Jody. And so we went out there and saw them. And yeah, and I've done some. I did a show with them like a couple years ago here. Anyway, they're cool people. But do you get out and do, like, now that everything's kind of lifted, are you back out playing shows? And
oh yeah, I've been doing a house concert series. Where just like the like house shows and stuff like that are really good. There's some theater shows and like listening rooms. Like I did the Ray Wiley show not too long ago in Decatur, Alabama, at the Princess Theater, which is an awesome place. Nice. And it's great. Mary McDonald that kind of runs the place. She's a big fan of like good music. So they get a good group. They get good shows there. Like as we're recording this, I'm getting ready to go to the Frank Brown Songwriter Festival in Orange Beach, Alabama. Oh, this, cool. this weekend, and I've got to go to, I'm being Key West. I got a busy festival scheduled coming up over the next couple of months.
Is that Key West? That's the thing that Mary Gauthier plays, and I think my friend Kelly Mickwee plays it.
This first trip is going to be a show. It's just going to be like a little, it's a show we do here in Nashville, or we used to do here in Nashville, called Revival. Uh-huh. And it's just like a, let the songs do the talking, kind of like a singer songwriter, song swap.
Oh, cool.
But they're going to do one in Key West the first week of December. And I'll go down for that. And then Mile Zero Fest at the end of January.
Oh, okay. That's the one that I was thinking of. Yeah.
I'll be going for that one too. And then doing the Steamboat Festival this year too.
Oh yeah. I played up there. I'm in a cover band called Skyrocket, and we were like the thing at the beginning of the night, like at 6 PM, okay. Whatever. We played a party like three nights in a row. That was like a happy hour party. Dude, that thing was insane. I got so drunk at that thing, dude. Like, I think the last day that we played, like, I threw up all day, and I was dying. That place. There's a lot of dudes up there dying. Like,
yeah, it's a tough environment.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. So you're gonna that. Are you part of that whole, like, do you know, like, who am I, the Braun Brothers, what's their band, Reckless Kelly? Like, do you know guys like that and, like, the Trishas? And
I'm familiar with some of them. My manager is based out of Texas, Dalton Domino, Honcho Music Group, and they are, he's put me on a lot of shows with some folks down there.
Texas folks. You going to be coming down here anytime soon? I'm in Austin.
I'm working on first and second quarter dates.
Okay.
Down that way. And try to get back down there.
Yeah. Let me know. So, I'd love to come out and see you and meet you in person.
Right on.
Yeah. Your record Quaalude Lullabies is gorgeous and, really like amazing songs, and just like it's a pleasure. Oh, that's what I was going to ask you. Did you guys, when you recorded songs like with the group, and even like something as like sparse, like the devil, the dealer, and the dark side, that's just like bass guitar and Wurlitzer, right?
Yeah.
Did you do that live like that? Did you guys all play together? Like, did the band play together when you played stuff, or did you piecemeal it?
We did. I cut vocals on some tracks. We cut most of the music. Actually, we cut all the music live.
Awesome. It has that feel.
And
man.
then Oh man, it's the I don't think there's another I don't think there's another way to do it. Like yeah. there's the I don't think I'll do it. I don't think I'll ever go and then like do punch ins or stuff like that. I do know that like I did recut vocals on some things because scratch vocals a few little things changed during the song, but we were able to keep the music. But on Devil and Dealer, and I think on Felt the Same, Fall Apart, Back on the Pills, yeah. and then Yellow Mama, we kept scratch vocals on all that. Like we kept the first vocal take on all of it.
That's great, man. It's great to think that you can still capture magic, you know? Like that's a thing that I really think, like in modern music and modern recording over the last 20 years, the capturing of magic is kind of like been thrown out the window, except for guys like us that want to try and, you know what I mean, do that. Try and do that. But it doesn't really seem like the focus of it. But there's so much magic in a performance that, you know, a raw performance is beautiful.
I think,
yeah. Sorry. I can start getting dramatic.
Yeah. I remember someone telling me years ago when I first like recorded this little small, like I recorded this little really shitty, like some demos that, everything was pieced together. It was like the same guy cut all, right. most of the music tracks. Right. And like, I didn't, you know, and then, once you hear a record and see how this, you'll never look at a record, how a record's recorded. You'll never listen to a song the same again. And like now I go back and like, I think about that. I'm like, we really just went in and played the song like we would on stage and nobody fucked it up. Like that was the,
yeah.
And so like, that was the,
yeah.
and Refinery Town was the first record that I ever cut to tape. The first time I ever recorded the tape, and we tracked live, and it was that was an experience. We didn't do that this time just because of budget constraints and studio space. But we still cut everything like we still cut everything live like we would the tape.
Yeah. Well, cool.
I think that's the way to go. Like I think if you're going to release singles, if you're just going to be one of the people like some of the people that do now that just release, you know, 8 singles over the course of a year or whatever, like record it how you want to. But if you're releasing records, like actual albums, like there's a little bit of beauty in cutting one, just like they would have cut one back in 19, just like they would have cut one back in like 1975.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something so human about your songs, about the stories, about the whole thing that, it would almost be criminal to roboticize it, if that's even a word.
I appreciate that. I think that's a, yeah. like I think that's, I mean, that's a very, that's a really, to me, that take that as a super nice compliment. It's a, like there's a reason that I left in count offs on 2 or 3 of the songs.
Yeah. 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 I like that.
And I was going to leave a false start in on like on one of them, but we ended up cutting it for a little bit of time, you know, cutting it down for the sake of the track not being, you know, not having too much dead space. But yeah. I think that's part of what conveys the human emotion.
Yeah.
into those songs, and they're not just some like something that's just, you know, that's put together in a factory. It's like it's a craft, and like they and the, you know, the people that played on it, the people that, you know, the engineers that mixed it and everything, the studio, all the studio help, everything just came together and to make a record that I'm the most proud of.
You should be. You really should be. This is an amazing record. Quaalude Lullabies. Get out there, people. Listen to it. Chris Canterbury Music is where you can find it. ChrisCanterburyMusic.com. Self-produced, too. That must be like a good... I mean, that just must be a good feeling. I mean, I know that when I've gone in and been the guy in charge of everything, of my thing, and I get like a positive response, and people are like, hey, this is your best shit, and you feel like it's your best shit, and you're like, wow, that's like... When you put me in charge of it, it's good. You know what I mean? That's a great feeling.
It's it is. It's one of the, like, when I went in, I was so nervous when I went in, like, with it, that I said, I was like all I have to do is go, like, the songs are good. Like, I've got really good players. The studio's good. It sounds good. I've heard stuff in here. Like, all I have to do is go in here and not fuck it up.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that's like, I just have to go in here and like mean out. Like, if anything happens to this record from here, it'll 100% be me
fucking it up,
making that.
Yeah,
exactly. It'll be me doing that.
Yeah.
So when I got done with it and listened to it, I was like, okay. I didn't come in and fuck it up.
Yeah.
Like, this is just like, this is great. And then after I got the final mixes, when I finally got the mixes back on it and listened to it, I'm like, man, I just produced a record.
That's right.
Like, that's something that, like, I'm not a musician in a sense of, like, I don't know. Like, I knew enough theory 21 years ago to, like, to know how to, you know how to get what some sounds the guitar makes and know how to, you know, and then, but, like, I don't know. It's like, I know what I hear in my head, and I know it's getting it from my head out of my mouth to other people and them understanding it.
Yeah. To me, it's like everybody has, like, a certain kind of song in them, and you either inherently like it or you don't. You know what I mean? That's why I think we like bands. We like the sort of noise this person makes. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel that way about you. I love your songs. You're really, really great.
I appreciate that, man. And I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, man. It's great having you.
It's always fun to come in and talk about myself.
It's nice. It's nice to give people a format to do that. It's a genuine practice for me to not talk about myself for a certain amount of time. So it's a good balance for me. Chris, it's been great talking to you, man. People, get out there and check out Quaalude Lullabies. Go to chriscanterburymusic.com for all of your Chris Canterbury needs. And, man, thank you so much for doing the show. I hope we get to meet in person someday.
Absolutely, man.
All right, man.
Well, okay, I'll hit you up when I make it down to Austin.
Please do, man. Great talking to you.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
All right, man.
There's an army inside my head. And a monster.
Gang, that was Chris Canterbury. What a great conversation. Get out there and check out his record, Quaalude Lullabies, available now wherever you stream and download music. You can find him at chriscanterburymusic.com. There'll be a link to it in the text of this podcast. I want to thank him for taking the time to do the show. What a great guy. What a great conversation, too. I enjoyed it. I really did. Hey, gang, don't forget, when you're out there checking out chriscanterburymusic.com, you can subscribe to this podcast and get a new show every Tuesday and every Friday. I've also been dropping From the Vault episodes Saturday nights at around midnight. Check your feed. If you subscribe, you'll get a notification whenever we drop a new show. So I'll be talking to David Garza from, like, Jesus, like 2012 or something, like a long time ago. It's an old, old show. So I hope you enjoy that. All right. Have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. Be safe. Have fun. Let's get down.
The devil, the demon. Dark side of me. Some days I'm, some days I'm not, some days I'm made to run out the clock. There's a fine line between here and there. Am I running free or running scared? What's heaven when hell crashes through it? A heart only breaks when you use it. The aces are all here to see. Devil, the dealer, and the dark side of me. Cold as a shoulder, dry as a bone. Memory is worthless if you make it alone. Once you make friends with the walls, what's left on your sentence don't matter at all. The truth doesn't care if you choose it. A heart only breaks when you use it. The mirror don't like what it sees. The devil, the dealer, and the dark side of me.